Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Wait a second, that sounds like Ted Nugent. Oh, no way, no way. A new Ted Nugent album just out. The music made me do it. And we are so happy to have him on. He's the host of the new podcast, The Ted Nugent Danger Zone with Tim Wells. And he's just one of our favorites. Singer, songwriter, guitarist, extraordinaire. And his tour kicks off on July 19th in Pasadena. And I'm just so thrilled to have him on. Ted Nugent, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing so good, Laura. It's stupid. Thanks for having me on, and happy summertime rock and roll barbecue season and Independence Day every damn day to
you. You bet. I was up in northern Minnesota, and I got to tell you, Minnesota is like a throwback to the 1970s rock and roll where I grew up. Okay, 70s, 80s. It was, you know, we were listening to rock. We're listening to some ZZ Top. Got a little Ted Nugent in there. We got some, old, incredible, awesome Aerosmith. And I was thinking, this is the way America. Remember growing up in the 70s? It's just the way it was. And it was really, politics.
It still is.
It was a blast.
It really still is. I mean, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and B.B. King and Freddie King, they're all still alive in our bellies. And all that killer, authentic, soulful, American, raising hell rock and roll music is still alive and well all across this country. I'm going on tour. This will be my 62nd year. That's 62 years of rock and roll. And Laura, I'm 71 this year, and I'm having so much fun. It's literally out of body. The music still does make me do it. And real music lovers just drive us nuts. So it's going to be the greatest tour of my life in 2019. How do you figure that, huh?
No, the longevity you've had in the entertainment business is absolutely stunning. I have to ask you music questions, if you don't mind, before we get into anything else.
Sure.
How are your hands after playing for all that time? Like, I have all sorts of, you know, repetitive stress from, you know, all the sports I've played. But how are your hands? How do you keep them limber, and how do you keep them moving as fast as they moved in your 20s?
Well, the name of the record is The Music Made Me Do It. The name of the tour is The Music Made Me Do It Again. I mean, I play my guitars every day. You could see the grin on my face right now and three really worn-out, tired dogs at my feet, Happy, aww, Sadie, and Coco. I just got in from playing my guitar and testing the amps for the tour. And that's the highest of highs. I felt like a horny teenager in a garage with my first loud amp. It really is fresh. Because I live a hunting, ranching, farming, fishing, trapping, outdoor, spirit of the wild lifestyle. And the healing powers of nature is what Jimi Hendrix needed. It's what John Belushi needed. It's what Bon Scott needed. It's what all those dead rockers needed. Elvis needed the healing powers of nature. But instead they used drugs and alcohol and just, you know, really suicidal, you know, so-called peer pressure mistakes. But I get away from the music, but I can't wait to get in my barn and plug in every day when I come in from the swamp or when I fillet a few bluegills for the dinner table. The juxtaposition of the primal goo of my hunting lifestyle, my outdoor lifestyle, compared to the electric hand-to-hand combat sonic warfare of my musical dreams, they're so opposite that they really inspire each other. So my fingers are cocked, locked, and ready to rock, Doc, because I play every day. So I don't think I have any. If I ever commit a crime, I'm going to use my left hand because I don't think I have finger impressions. You can't take my fingerprints anymore. But
so
I keep myself in good shape. You know, I've been clean and sober for 71 years, so my focus remains pretty damn good.
Did you ever have a drink in your life?
Yeah, I had a couple beers one time. I think I had a half a beer once after a grouse hunt because it was really hot and nobody had anything else to drink. And it was delicious, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then my sons and my daughters and my brothers and sisters, when we have Thanksgiving dinner, they like a little wine. In fact, I have a little wine once in a while with some venison backstraps on the grill with Mrs. Nugent. So I'm not like I'm militantly against alcohol. I think it qualifies as a beverage in responsible quantities.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I've never done the drugs or alcohol or tobacco.
So
and I do chew on a cigar when I shoot my machine guns because I feel like Sergeant Rock and it just seems to be the appropriate image. But I don't think I really smoke it. I think I just chew on it.
Oh my gosh. Ted, first of all, I was thinking, I knew I was going to have you on. And so I had my kids. We were up at a friend's farm, and I was with a number of just great folks. And my kids had never shot before. And it was so great to have like 4 6-foot-5 guys who are just incredible, old family friends, just great people who are big, big hunters. I mean, they're into, but they're incredibly responsible. It's all about gun safety. It's about respecting
sure.
the firearm. It's about every aspect of gun safety. I think they went over it. They must have gone over it 20 times. And they quiz the kids. And my kids are 14, 11, and 9. Two boys, the youngest and the older is the girl. And the kids were curious, but they weren't clamoring to shoot. Maybe the little one, Nico, who's a total piece of work, he was clamoring to shoot. But the other ones weren't. And I finally said, come on, guys, you're in this spectacular place, total safety. We have the best, you know, people to teach you. And sure enough, my daughter gets up there. It's just a little 22 rifle. Then she was shooting a Glock. She gets up there and it's a target about, maybe it was about 38, 40 yards. She hit every one out of 10 except two. And I was like,
because you're a good mother and you've disciplined them. Marksmanship and firearm safety. We just celebrated, Laura, our 30th year of the Ted Nugent Camp for Kids charity, where we've graduated close to 18,000 young boys and girls into being the best that you can be. You know, finding that spirit within of your American dream, clean and sober. And when these kids, and a lot of them are inner city kids because a lot of our camp directors are law enforcement and military, and they seek out kids that need that extra bit of love and extra attention and extra discipline. Mm-hmm. But that aim small, miss small, samurai focus. And I don't care if you're fascinated by guns or you're totally disinterested. By the time you learn that breathing, sight acquisition, trigger squeeze, there is a samurai that will be manifested in our lives when you dedicate your entire being to aim small, miss small. And it works with writing, it works with guitar playing, it works mm-hmm. with welding. But ultimately, everybody's fascinated with firearms because it represents that self-evident truth that our founding fathers wrote down, because it's about defending your sacred gift of life in its mm-hmm. ultimate application. So, yeah, I've never met anybody, including a bunch of goofy hippies I used to hang out with, who were against guns. They wanted to ban guns until they got to the range and mm-hmm. found that inner zen of being the path of your life, which is the projectile management of marksmanship. And it really is the highest of highs when you apply yourself to that.
And I think young people, when they learn about the safety aspects, the power of a firearm, and the beauty of hitting that target just right, that's the best thing, in a way, you can teach kids if you're going to ever expose them to guns, which, you know, it's
well, you want
it's
accountability.
Not,
you want them to
yeah,
learn.
Absolutely.
I wrote in my book, God, Guns, and Rock and Roll, I had a whole chapter about how I was trained mm-hmm. to fear the punishment of mishandling a firearm by
absolutely.
My dad. Absolutely.
And we were teaching our
two.
Kids. Yep. Yeah,
so that's an important training process.
But the girls are good shots naturally. I think women have a sense of natural.
The girls are always better.
My daughter was unbelievable. She turns around and I said, drop that barrel. Put it down before you turn around to me. You know the old thing when kids turn around and they're like, no. But she is incredible. I mean, they learn fast, but you have to drill the safety into them, and you have to go over it painstakingly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps, and they get it drilled in. It's like riding a bike. Then you know it, but you still have to do the pre-flight check with firearms. Is there anything in the chamber? Cock it back. Look twice. Look, is the clip out? Look to see if there's anything in the chamber. And we must have done that 50. I think we must have done that 50 times. Easily. 50
times.
I do
it every day.
Yeah. Where do you live again, Ted? I always forget. Where do you live?
Well, I'm a Texan now because I'm addicted to freedom and Michigan.
No taxes.
I was born in Detroit. You know, Laura, Michigan was the arsenal of democracy. It was the epicenter of work ethic and pride of productivity when I was born in 48.
Yep.
But unfortunately, it's turned into a suburb of San Francisco now politically, and it just breaks my heart. California, Oregon, Washington, Michigan, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Massachusetts, those states don't even qualify as America anymore. It's just heartbreaking. But I'm in Michigan now in the swamps. In preparation for the tour, the dogs and Shemaine and I come up here every year to get ready to tour because we start out west and all my equipment is here. But Texan now, but I'm speaking from the soul-cleansing swamps of my sacred Michigan, which I'm fighting to keep Michigan, and I think we will persevere.
Oh, boy, we have to keep Michigan in 2020. And Ted, when you look at your career and the span of your career, do you look at periods of time, decades, and think, gosh, I was a different person then than I am now? And it's interesting I'm kind of doing that in a number of ways. And you take stock of your life, and you didn't make probably a lot of crazy, bad decisions that a lot of people make. But it's interesting with the passage of time, the changes to your way of appreciation of the things that you used to take for granted. I guess because there's less time left in your life. I find that.
Well, it's fascinating because I do a lot of interviews because I'm a strange rock and roller in that I'm hardcore anti-substance abuse. I'm hardcore pro-Second Amendment, pro-hunting, fishing, and conservation. And that doesn't fit in with the status quo paradigm of your typical stoner rocker out there. And I got to say that a lot of the guys in rock and roll are my dear friends, and they're good people. And whether they get high or don't get high, I still love them, and I still have musical communication and family communication. But at the tender age of 71, as I'm approaching my 71st birthday, which I think is just precious, because there's nothing I do today that I really do any different than I was 20 years old or 16 years old. I still shoot my bow and arrow. I've got dogs, but now I have grandkids and kids, but I still communicate with my brothers and sisters, and I still have a rock and roll band like I did 60 years ago. So my focus is always about putting my heart and soul into being the best that I can be. That's how my mom and dad disciplined me and raised me, thank God, huh? And so I'm often able to, you know, reminisce when I do interviews with you and we talk about the past, because the past can be an indicator for your future if you've learned your lessons from the past. But I got to tell you, when I graduated from high school in 67, I had been so militantly disciplined by my mom and dad. Now, I could have gone the other way and rebelled and become a complete drooling idiot hippie, but luckily, I saw really idiot, drooling hippies all around me, and I saw that the drugs and alcohol turned otherwise nice, good people into drooling idiots, and so I avoided the system by which you become a drooling idiot. And I never abused my sacred temple. I've always been a hunter, so I've always eaten organic before it was hip, and I've had a damn good life, and if you see my kids, my sons and daughters, my grandkids, my brothers, my sisters, my band, my incredible wife, Shemaine, are you kidding me? I talked to my guitar player yesterday from 1964, and he said, Nugent, you haven't changed. You're still crazy. You're still out of control.
Why are those snobs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Why didn't they put you in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? How is it possible? And you see all these people.
Because I don't believe in drugs, and I'm pro-Second Amendment, and because I murder innocent animals. You know, when I take my bow and arrow, I'm
That's
a coward
amazing.
Because I murder innocent animals.
That's
to
amazing.
Feed my family.
Yeah, and they
homeless shelter.
Yeah, and they are in favor of infanticide, but that's okay. It's save the whales, abort the babies.
Can you believe it?
Yeah, save the whales, abort the babies. It's like one thing if they believed in killing nothing, but they have no problem with a million babies a year gone. That's apparently fine.
Is that so? Well, Laura, you and I have been around, but you know, there's a lot of bad and ugly, and thank you for celebrating and pounding home truth, logic, and common sense. We so look up to you for being our voice out there in the asset column of this country, who we have to be accountable. We have to be productive. We have to have a work ethic. It's in our spirit. And when Laura Ingram speaks, you speak for us. So thank you for that.
You're the best. Tell me about your band. I'm always I'm into music. Always have been. So I'm always into who's traveling with you. How'd you meet them? Any original band members? You know, what? Tell us about that.
Well, I was born in Detroit, and my God, the musical authority that just erupted every day from every street corner in Detroit when I was born, because Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and Little Richard had passed on what the Howlin' Wolves and the Muddy Waters and the Mose Allison and the Lightnin' Hopkins and these original black, soulful, emoting musical gods had created. And then Motown happened, where they coalesced all this various music from gospel and blues and soul and the African aboriginal chants, you know, to the Great Spirit. That's really why I'm a hunter, I think, is because I connect with the black Africans and the Native Americans. And I bring that up because the grind of real gospel and rhythm and blues music that was manifested in its ultimate form from Motown also bled into the streets as the original drum beat from that hunter who beat on a stretched skin and twanged the bow and arrow, and that was the first guitar note. So I'm really connected to that primal scream. And when there's a Howlin' Wolf and then obviously James Brown and Motown, it impacted every band in Detroit. And I've been so blessed beyond measure, from the Amboy Dukes and the Lords in 1960, and then when I was with the damn Yankees with Tommy and Jack and Michael, and today I've got Greg Smith on bass guitar for a long time, and a 23-year-old animal drummer, 23 years old, Laura, from Detroit. His name is Jason Heartless. And these guys put so much piss and vinegar and energy and attitude.
Well, how'd you find
them?
Well,
they found me because I've got the coolest songs in the world, and every killer musician wants to play my songs. Mm-hmm. And so we communicate, and we run into each other on the road and different places where we jam, and we become musical blood brothers. And these guys, I'm telling you, if I wasn't in this band, Laura, I'd go see them every night. Jason and Greg, they create breeding music. I mean, it's just a spiritual grinding that they produce every night. And they do it to my songs that I wrote, which are like my children, my musical children. And when you see guys put their heart and soul into your songs every night, every song, every gig, I'm telling you, I genuflect at the altar of thanking God every day, because my music has a life of its own because of the musicians that I've been surrounded with all my life.
Yeah, and anyone who doesn't give a huge tribute every night to his band is really not, you know, it's not, and it's not cool. But the greats always did. I mean, of course, the John Bonham, who probably, God rest his soul, went way too young, again, drugs, right, and all the
That's
problems.
Right, yeah.
That phenomenal drummer, but what it takes to be a good musician, Ted, versus a great musician. Tell me what the difference is. A good versus great. Some of it is genetic talent. There's no doubt about it. Some people just have a genetic, like Oscar Peterson. There'll never be another Oscar Peterson. There'll never be another Ray Charles. There's just never going to be another one. And probably never be another John Bonham. At least I haven't seen one. But tell me the difference between
doing a damn close job. Yeah.
Good and great. Tell me the difference.
Well, it's like everything in life. I've got some mechanics that work on my trucks, and I've got welders that I weld with, and I got farmers that I plant and plow and harvest with. And you can tell a dedication level. And it's the same thing with a TV host or a songwriter or a mechanic or a plumber. You see people who really love what they're doing, because the work ethic involved, if you really calculate it, the compensation, even to the richest rock and rollers on the planet, guys who have, you know, $500 million, if you looked at what Sammy Hagar puts into his music, he probably got about $1.50 an hour, because it never ends. You work and you struggle and you sacrifice and you experiment with new notes and new sounds and new musical adventure. And it's a consuming dedication. You know, I got to race against Bruce Jenner when he was the gold medalist god of the world, the man's man, the most athletic, supreme beast that ever lived. And when I first met Bruce Jenner, we did some off-road racing together. And just the way he attacked every endeavor. And I was already in the attack mode because I was raised in the incredible competition music zone of Detroit, where you better kick maximum ass or you're not going to make it.
Right.
And the competition was supreme. So I've witnessed these people, and the musicians in my band, Greg and Jason, they live this stuff. The name of the record is The Music Made Me Do It. You can't be this good if you want to be a rock star, because that's phony. You can't be this good because you want to be a celebrity, because that's transparent. You have to dedicate your heart and soul. And this is what we teach our kids at the Ted Nugent Camp for Kids charity. Whatever your American dream is, whatever your goal in life is, God gave you incredible powers and gifts. If you apply those powers and gifts, clean and sober, to their maximum effect, you can do anything. And the musicians that are superhuman, I got to jam with Jimi Hendrix and B.B. King. I played bass for Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, Laura. I know what supreme animals look like, and they taught me. I wanted to be James Brown growing up, and you can imagine his work ethic. Everybody knew he was the hardest working man in show business, and those were our inspirations. And every musician I know, you just named a bunch, from Cheap Trick to Aerosmith to ZZ Top, I know these guys. These are my buddies. They're all that dedicated. They will hone their craft so that that audience is absolutely gratified and intensified, and that's the dedication it takes in any endeavor, I think.
No, and I think, again, people wonder why to society, whether you were talking about how you dress on planes, Ted, and how people show up, which I've been talking about for years. Little things matter on the path to greatness. Little things. And if you dress,
yeah,
attentive to attention to detail, the way you hold the guitar, the way you, then a number of minutes a day that you practice, how you take care of your instrument, how you take care of your body, whether you dress for success or dress, you know, like you should be, you know, at the beach in public.
My dad was hardcore on posture. Stand up straight. Carry yourself with dignity. And if you met my sons and daughters, and again, my band, my crew, everybody in my life, Doug, Linda, everybody in my life, the Spirit of the Wild production team, our Camp for Kids directors and their volunteers, everybody carries themselves with pride and confidence. You know, you can't get self-esteem. You have to earn and cultivate individual, rugged individual self-esteem. And that's the missing link with this liberalism and this socialism. It's literally incentivizing slovenliness and irresponsible behavior. And that's where the obesity epidemic came from. People just have been brainwashed. I call it mushy brained. We're all mushy brained when we're young. We're looking for information and knowledge. And if you're not disciplined to be the best that you can be, you'll probably end up irresponsible. You might end up in jail. You might end up dead. But you see a lot of these manifestations of a cultural abandonment in our society with the self-inflicted, the horrors of health dilemmas. They're all choices. What are the medical profession has said over and over again that 96 to 98% of health problems in America are a direct result of stupid choices. What kind of nasty food and what kind of nasty quantities and the smoking and the drinking and the drugs and comfortably numb. I don't recognize that. That's some foreign, irresponsible goofball as I'm concerned. Ted, and I don't have any irresponsible goofballs in my life.
Yeah, we're talking to Ted Nugent here on the Laura Ingram podcast, and he's kicking off his new tour on July 19th in Pasadena, and his new album, The Music Made Me Do It Again. That's the name of his tour as well. Ted, a good friend of mine who knows literally everything about rock and roll that I can think of, like every fact, every band member, every song, Yeah, we're listening to the radio and some pop song comes on. It's like, you know, totally computerized and auto-tuned, and he and I say rock and roll is so dead. It's dead. Is that accurate? And if not, what bands are great rock and roll bands that are of, you know, the more recent vintage?
Well, you know, it's not dead. But it's dead in many people's lives. It's not dead in real music lovers' life. We have Greta Van Fleet out of Grand Rapids, Michigan here, another perfect example of it, that spirit of musical creativity and adventure.
She's not going to fill a stadium, Ted. Ted, if she's not going, who's going to fill a stadium, a rock and roll band today?
Well, real rock and rollers like me and Aerosmith and ZZ Top. And
not from the 1970s. Not from the 1970s. Someone
who
was born after 1990 or after, 1990. Where is it?
Yeah, you're right. Now, the Foo Fighters are not really a new band, but
they're a 1990s band. Yeah, they were at their heyday in the 1990s. There's nobody. I'm saying there's nobody. There's nobody.
You know, again, the left, the agenda of the liberals and the socialists, they control Hollywood, academia, so much of the media, and unfortunately so much of our government. When you have that leftist socialism, don't be the best that you can be. You should try to get away with being as worthless as you can be, and we'll still send you a guaranteed income. I mean, some of the things out of a liberal's mouth, it's like spiritual murder. They're murdering the spirit of people. And when you murder the spirit, the first thing that's going to die is art, because you're not incentivized to make all the sacrifice to create this great music. You're not going to stay in the house and practice your ass off if there's not a paycheck at the end of the day, even though I did it before there was a paycheck. But you've got to be driven by the music, and when you do excellent work, whether you're an excellent orchard operator or an excellent mechanic, you don't have to do it for the compensation. You do it for the craft, and the compensation will come. It's called capitalism. Are you kidding me? So you're right, Laura. When you hear some of this new country music, I mean,
no,
it's like
it's
the
awful.
Monkees. It's, even though the Monkees
awful.
Were a better band
no,
than
Monkees
a lot of
were
these
much
country
better.
Guys.
Yeah, Monkees
it's
much
it's formula. It's all formula. It's the same songwriters, the same goofy lyrics. And here's the horror of horrors. In the best country music, and I got a lot of friends, Blake Shelton's a good friend, and Toby Keith has some killer musicians and creative artists out there. But when you hear the mix, where's the damn guitar solo? That's the crescendo. That's the peak of the sexuality of the song. And if there is a guitar solo, and there's some great guitarists out there, it's not even up in the mix like Billy Gibbons or Eddie Van Halen's or my guitar solo, because they don't care about it anymore. It breaks my heart.
And Ted, I have to ask you about the U.S. Women's World Cup champion women's team, Megan Rapinoe, who's been all over the place. She's incredible athletic talent. She and Trump obviously aren't buddies. She was on with Anderson Cooper last night, and she said this:
"The moments kneeling were difficult for you."
Yeah, it was.
Because of people's
heavy.
Reaction, or
a little bit, yeah. But it also, it was difficult and heavy. But I had this immense sense of pride and responsibility in doing that. So I think that's where the strength of doing it a number of times came from.
So it's hard to kneel for the national anthem, and she felt an enormous sense of pride. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Laura, like you and everybody in the asset column, and she is in the asset column. I mean, what dedication to supreme athleticism. A big salute to all those amazing athletes.
That's a given. We've all congratulated them, and that's amazing. But now
we're on to kneeling for the anthem,
and you know, being proud of it, and that's hard. And
well, where does the lie start that this president is a racist or a bigot, or he doesn't like gays or lesbians? Where does this come from? I know President Trump. People say I'm a racist. I'm anything but a racist. People who call me a racist are the racists. And if you're gay or lesbian or you're confused about your gender, I don't know anybody who cares. We want you to be happy. We want you to be able to make your own choices in life. But where does this lie that this tidal wave of bigotry and hate comes from the right? I've been in this world for 71 years this year. I've never met a racist. I knew the Klan existed, and I knew people were against, you know, freedom, and I know there's Nazis and goofballs all over the world, but when you prioritize your quality of life and you always judge based on content of character, racists won't come near you. Bigots won't enter your life. Where does she get the lie? Where does the left get the lie that President Trump wants to make America white again? Nancy Pelosi, what kind of mind-altering chemicals are you on to think such a nasty, false, hateful thing about a great president who I happen to believe is the greatest president, and he really is making America America again? So I'm confused, like everybody who lives in truth, logic, and common sense, why hate? Well, and not only that, but reference to their hate, it's unsubstantiated.
Well,
it's all a lie.
It's more simply put than that, and I would say they don't really believe what they're saying. They don't really believe Donald Trump supports Nazis. It's just on its face ludicrous. What they know is that they can't argue this economy, so they have to make sure African-Americans don't turn out for Donald Trump in any number, because if they do, then they're going to lose. So they have to say he's racist. Everyone who supports him is racist. He's a bad person. If you vote for him, you're a bad person. And hence, Megan Rapinoe is just another conduit through which that message is publicized. Let's listen.
What is your message to the president?
Oh, message to the president. I think that I would say that your message is excluding people. You're excluding me. You're excluding people that look like me. You're excluding people of color. You're excluding, you know, Americans that that maybe support you.
I don't even know.
Hey, Megan, write this down. The president doesn't exclude anyone, period.
Well, the economy is working better for minority women business owners, African-American and Hispanic, than it's ever worked. Most of the jobs, half of the jobs created for minorities.
What level of effort is necessary to continue to lie to yourself about this president, about Republicans, about conservatives, about the NRA? I mean, to what level of effort do you have to go to lie to yourself to make up these nasty, hateful lies about all the best people in the world? I've been a life member of the NRA for my entire adult life. I'm on the board of directors with some of the highest votes. The NRA is a civil rights organization making sure that all free people have the right to defend themselves. How could you possibly hate that?
And Ted, before we let you go, what is going on with the NRA? I'm very worried about all the stuff that I'm hearing about.
Well, it's an important time because the freedom-hating media, they hate the NRA as much as they hate me. I couldn't be more proud that nasty, negative, hateful people hate me. They hate guns. They want to blame guns for crimes. All the statistics blow that argument completely out of the water, so they can't take on a debate with someone like me or Wayne LaPierre or Chris Cox or any of my fellow NRA members. So they just got to take advantage of the hateful media and academia and Hollywood and continually spreading their hate. But bottom line is the NRA is strong. It's a mom-and-pop family civil rights organization that believes in self-defense. We are online with our budget. All the allegations about misspending and inappropriate behavior are absolute lies. The board of directors is dedicated to total transparency and accountability. We will make sure that the world knows that the NRA is about the right to keep and bear arms. That is a self-evident truth written down by our founding fathers, an individual right from God, and we will fight tooth and nail to make sure it is not infringed. That's what the NRA is, and I couldn't be more proud to be a part of it.
Well, Ted Nugent, we're just so happy to have talked to you today, and so happy about the launch of your tour, your album. And remember, everyone needs to listen also to Ted's podcast, Ted Nugent, Danger Zone with Tim Wells. It's fantastic. The music made me do it again. The album and the tour kicks off July 19th in Pasadena. And find more information about where Ted's going to be on his website, which we'll link up on lauraingram.com and our Facebook page. Ted, you stay safe out there, my friend. Rock and roll. Can't wait to see you. So we'll hopefully catch you when you're on the East Coast.
Thank you, Laura. Godspeed. Have the greatest summer of your life. Aim small, miss small. Thank you for all that you do on behalf of the great families of this country.
God bless. Ted Nugent here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
There was a time. Yours was yours and mine was mine.
Do you wish that you could make your double chin just poof go away? Oh, I'm sure you do. Americans have problems when they get older, maybe they gain a little bit of weight, with their chin area. It's just tough, especially, you know, as you get older. Gentlemen, ladies, it's the same deal. We all want to look our best. Well, Genucel Jawline Cream really is something you should consider trying. Just try it on your neck and your skin or on your jawline for 2 or 3 days. And I think you'll begin to see a real difference, as do so many who've already tried it. I usually in the late morning before I, you know, get into my daily routine for the television show, because I work out in the morning. So I don't want to put my cream on in the right when I wake up before I work out. So I use it midday. It's a fantastic product. And by the way, it has MDL technology in the proprietary base that Chamonix, who makes all the Genucel products, that they use. And the brand new Genucel Jawline Treatment, it targets that delicate skin around your neck and your jawline, and it helps make it look tighter, more healthy, more vibrant, and as a result, it looks younger. So see results right before your eyes, or guess what? You don't like the results, 100% money back, no questions asked. That's a great guarantee. It's a no-brainer. So order now. And the classic Genucel for bags and puffiness that I do use twice a day, free with your order. And to start seeing results really fast, Genucel Immediate Effects is also yours free. So go to Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com, Genucel.com. Get your 2 free gifts and free express shipping by going to Genucel.com.
This whole 2-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
If you wanted an FBI investigation, you could have come to us. What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You said that, not me. You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said all of them, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics. And if you really wanted to know the truth, you sure as hell wouldn't have done what you've done to this guy.
Wow, that brings it all back, doesn't it? It seems in a way like it was yesterday, and then it seems like it was years ago. It's just one of those seminal moments in American judicial history and political history. The number one book in the nation, it's just out yesterday. Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Delighted you're with us. And remember, you will hear on this podcast what you won't hear anywhere else, on politics, the culture, everything in between. Molly Hemingway from Fox News and The Federalist, and Carrie Severino from the Judicial Crisis Network are the co-authors of this brand new smash book with enormous amount of actual real reporting, interviews, behind the scenes, fact digging and analysis. They just, again, not going to get anywhere else unless you get this book. It's our featured selection on LauraIngraham.com and on the Facebook page. So make sure to get this book, be informed about what may be coming down the pike again and who the real liars were in this assault on a Trump nominee to the Supreme Court. They both join us now. Ladies, it's great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. There's a lot I want to get to, and everybody knows that Carrie and I both, different times, I'm much older than Carrie, clerked for Justice Thomas on the court. So the Supreme Court is an issue that's important to all of us. But once you clerked on the court, you have a special affinity for the institution, the place, and And I'm just so glad that she was involved in, as the co-author of this book with Molly. So, Carrie, let's start with you. Your book is filled with, well, important fact-checking on what was alleged against Kavanaugh and what was glaringly false. And I want to start with the first claim that she made. Let's listen.
Have you ever had discussions with anyone besides your attorneys on how to take a polygraph?
Never. I was scared of the test itself, but was comfortable that I could tell the information and the test would reveal whatever it was going to reveal. I didn't expect it to be as long as it was going to be, so it was a little bit stressful.
Have you ever given tips or advice to somebody who was looking to take a polygraph test?
Never.
Carrie, let's go to you. Why was that false?
Well, this is one of the fun stories to really dig in and pick into the details of. We tell the story in Justice on Trial of how they got that information in the first place. You know, Rachel Mitchell, a lot of people said, oh, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's not the attack dog they wanted. She knew exactly what she was doing. She knew that it turns out Blasey Ford's ex-boyfriend had said this is something that she had done. She had trained someone else on polygraph. So she was going somewhere with those questions. One of the other things that we uncover for the first time, you know, the left was looking at everyone sitting behind Kavanaugh, trying to figure out who each person was, and then going and harassing those individuals for standing up for him. They didn't ask who was sitting with her. And Monica McLean, the woman who came out, was the one she alleged that was alleged to have prepped on the polygraph, who then later denied it. She was actually right there with Christine Blasey Ford. She was walking in and out of the prep room with her. So I think it's really intriguing to see some of these details that, you know, weren't being discovered and reported at the time.
Lie number two. This will go to Molly. Let's listen.
What is the strongest memory you have? Strongest memory of the incident? Something that you cannot forget. Take whatever time you need.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
The hippocampus thing was, I'm sorry, when I heard it, I said it's a complete and utter lie. Why was that phrasing leading you to believe that was false?
Right. When this happened, you had a lot of people in the media say, oh, wow, she is so credible. She just said that this was indelible in the hippocampus. And we spoke with memory experts who said that, frankly, the whole notion of anything related to memory being indelible is absurd. People have issues with memory all the time. There are ways to ascertain whether a memory is false or accurate, but nothing is indelible. And there should have been some questions asked by people who were scrutinizing this account, and instead they just sort of reflexively accepted it. It was interesting. We also showed that it was part of the actual like public relations rollout to remark on laughter. So whether it was the allegation from Christine Blasey Ford or the absolutely absurd allegations that were referred for criminal referral, people kept mentioning laughter. It was clearly part of a campaign to paint an image of Brett Kavanaugh, which was at odds with the actual historical record.
Carrie, there was another moment which for a lot of us who especially those of us who are familiar with a lot of the players involved and friends with a lot of the folks who knew her contemporaneously as I am, this was another one that struck me. Let's listen.
In your letter, you said that they went down the stairs and they were talking with other people in the house.
Correct.
Were you able to hear that conversation?
I was not able to hear that conversation.
How do you know there was a conversation?
I'm just assuming since it was a social gathering, people were talking. I don't know.
You said that you do not remember how you got home. Is that correct?
I do not remember.
Okay.
Other than I did not drive home.
Okay. Has anyone come forward to say to you, hey, remember, I was the one that drove you home?
No.
What do we know about the veracity of that, Carrie?
Yeah, this was one of the really fun moments that Molly and I had in reporting Justice on Trial. We decided, you know, we're going to take this drive. We're going to start at Columbia Country Club and drive to the Blasey home and see, could she have gotten home without calling on someone to pick her up? And that, I'll tell you, that is a long, winding drive. It took us like 20 minutes, and there's not sidewalks, I don't think, on the whole thing. I don't think it would have been lit. This is really hard to imagine in the context of the 80s, where, of course, no one has a cell phone. She's not going to call Uber. It's not an area where there's taxi cabs driving down the street. So it makes it all sound very implausible.
But even more than that, we spoke with people who were very familiar with driving her around. Her friends and people close to her said that she was known to be driven around by her brother and Leland Kaiser, who was the woman she named as the witness to the events, who said that she had, she remembered the summer well, but she had no recollection of any such party or ever having met Kavanaugh. And yet they did have memories of driving her around and what it was like, because that was kind of their role in their relationship with her. So it was interesting that when the story first came out, it was so vague and people really, really exploited the vagueness of it. But as people started to remember more about that summer, nothing buttressed the claim. Anyone can make an allegation, but you need to have support for claims. And the support never came from throughout this ordeal.
Well, they wanted people to believe her and not Brett Kavanaugh, based not so much on facts, as you point out, Molly, but on pure emotion. That look at this poor woman. She's such a sympathetic person. Why would she put herself through this? And Maisie Hirono from Hawaii amplified that notion. Let's listen.
We heard from Dr. Christine Ford, who spoke to us with quiet, raw, emotional power about what happened to her. She said she was 100% certain that it was you who attacked her. And she explained how she came forward, how she struggled with her decision, how she wanted the president to know so that he could make a better choice. So when you and my colleagues on the other side accuse us of ambushing you with false charges, I think we all have to remember Dr. Ford's testimony and her courage.
So that's the way they describe it. Courage, raw emotional power. These are terms that are meant to manipulate and override factual concerns, Molly, about the presentation of facts four decades later.
Right. It's very easy to manipulate emotions, particularly when you have a compliant media operation that is not asking any tough questions. And it's why one of the things we cared about in Justice on Trial, it's not just Justice Brett Kavanaugh being on trial, but the very notion of due process. This is something that we hold in such high regard that we have presumption of innocence until guilt is proven. And Rachel Mitchell, who asks these questions of the accuser, ends up writing a report where she says, not only was there not enough here to convict someone, there wasn't even enough to get a search warrant. The idea that you would say that this was emotionally true as opposed to actually supported by the evidence is absurd. And it was particularly galling for people, we learned in our reporting, that even justices on the court were particularly appalled to see that these senators were able to just avoid talking about due process. And, you know, things that you would never get away with in a courtroom were allowed during these proceedings, and it made a mockery of the entire process.
We're talking to Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. Their book, Justice on Trial, it's just out. It's number one on Amazon. And it chronicles and investigates the people, the places, the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh in his confirmation hearing. There were a lot of moments during this hearing that were stunning, a lot of them. But one claim that was made by commentator Jeffrey Toobin was spread by many media sources, and it was meant to inoculate Christine Blasey Ford as having any political motivation for this late hit against the nominee. Let's listen.
We have heard a woman who has no motive to lie, who has no reason to come forward, who does not have a political agenda, giving a vivid and highly believable description of a sexual assault by this nominee for the Supreme Court. We have then heard from a belligerent, angry, enraged Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that, Molly? I mean, she had no political agenda.
That's just not actually true, which is not to say, you know, just because someone has a political agenda doesn't have a bearing necessarily on what they're saying. But not only did she have an agenda, she was well known among her friends who kept in contact with her that she had one of these Facebook pages that had a lot of anti-Trump messaging and whatnot. That was scrubbed before she called the Washington Post to begin these allegations against Kavanaugh, which is curious and interesting and very different from the way she was portrayed. But it was also interesting to talk with just people who knew her from childhood. And, you know, these aren't people who have negative views of her, but they thought that talking point, these are females who said this idea that women would never, ever lie. They said, you know, we do have people in our lives who have said things that are not true. Or, you know, if you have any friend that's gone through a divorce or something, you, of course, hear each side say outlandish things. And then you have to turn around and pretend that it's never even conceivable that someone might not be telling the truth. And yet these cliches were just uttered as if, you couldn't even question the veracity of literally any woman on earth, unless it was a woman defending the reputation of Brett Kavanaugh. He had actual real people who had known him his whole life, who were coming out and saying, we know this guy, we know him well. There are very few men on earth whose reputation we would defend, and he is one of the very few of them. But when they came out, there was media silence. When people who didn't even know him would say that his character was lacking, it was elevated in the conversation.
Molly, let's go to Carrie, actually. How can we be confident, or can we be confident, better way of wording it, that this kind of circus won't play out again in the next confirmation fight if Donald Trump is president?
Well, that is really the reason we wrote Justice on Trial. We and you and I both saw what they had done after Justice Thomas at the bench, which is a campaign of disinformation to try to discredit him. And we can see them trying to start to do that about Kavanaugh as well. So we think the first important thing is making sure the facts are out there. So this is not going to be able to be perceived as a win for them. They certainly didn't get him on the court. And that is a very good thing, because that would have didn't block him. That would have really encouraged these kind of attacks in the future. But I think we also have to make sure the American people is aware of these tactics so that they can be inoculated against them. I think the other really key thing is, you know, if we had justices on the court who viewed it as their job simply to look at the text of the law and the Constitution, we wouldn't be in this mess. It's when judges act like politicians. And we know we've had justices like Justice Scalia talked about this a lot, and others who said if they're going to be acting like politicians, it's no wonder we get a political sideshow every time this happens. And so it's so encouraging to have Trump appointing nominees who do take that role seriously, because then it throws it back to Congress. Let Congress write the laws, and then the courts will apply them whether they agree or disagree with them. But the justices need to be not part of that political movement. So I think if we can keep the court out of it and keep the American people sort of woke to what happened and on their guard next time, that'll be the first best.
Well, there has to be consequences for false allegations, though. I mean, right now there are no consequences. You can leak something as a Senate staffer. You can leak it. No penalty to be paid. You can make false allegations. Julie Swetnick was supposed to be prosecuted. Michael Avenatti is being prosecuted for something else. And frankly, Christine Blasey Ford, she raises $800,000+ on GoFundMe. Not clear where any of that went. And this was a lie. And right, people can just do this. And I don't have any confidence at all that this, you know, I love your book, but the left doesn't care. They don't care about your book. They care about taking people down. Republicans worry about being genteel and making sure they're not going to offend anyone. But the Democrats, it's by any means necessary. This is war every day. They're coming after hosts on Fox News with spurious false allegations. They do that to me every day. And they're doing it to anyone connected with Donald Trump. I mean, they are just playing this as a blood sport, guys. Molly, you can close out.
Yes, this is very much why we cared about this. You played the part from Lindsey Graham where he's giving this wonderful speech, but he's now in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Why has it not been investigated, the game playing with this allegation? That absolutely is in his purview, and it should happen. There should be accountability. Nobody was fired in the media for running false claims. And in fact, you have all these people on the right who keep playing around with the media as if what they did was acceptable or tolerable or within the realm of acceptability. That that is not a good way to have these things not happen again. And it's a disservice to the American people who expect their leaders to push harder against reprehensible things like what we saw with the Kavanaugh confirmation. We hope that by telling the story, getting the real facts out there, it will push some of these people to do a better job holding some people accountable for their actions.
Carrie, one more question. We didn't get to it on Fox because I don't want this to be in any way about me. But apparently you did uncover something about my role in that's sort of related to the judicial process up leading up into 2016. What did you uncover?
Yeah, that was really another fun thing we learned. We were talking about the list because I think it's important to understand where we are now to understand this whole process and how important that list was in Donald Trump's campaign. One of the things that we learned, Laura, was how you were instrumental in helping him crystallize having that list, not just as an advisory rule, but as this is the group I'm choosing from. So after he put out the first list, and Ted Cruz and a lot of others were critical, saying, well, that's nice to say I'll choose someone like these people, but you need to say this is going to be the only list so you actually are locked down. And we learned that you were helpful in brokering that process, which was really the key thing, along with adding Mike Lee to that list, that helped Trump, or that helped Cruz finally come to the conclusion that he wanted to fully support Trump. And I think for a lot of other Americans as well.
Oh, fantastic. Well, guys, thank you for this book. Thank you for all the work you put into it. This took an enormous amount of time and real reporting, which sadly we see far too little of in the United States today. And this is one of those moments where we'll be like, where were you when? And we'll all remember it. Molly Hemingway, Carrie Severino, the book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, The Future of the Supreme Court. It's number one in the country. It's a great summer read. It's a great read. So we hope this doesn't happen again. Ladies, congratulations. We're so happy for you and frankly happy for the country that you're out there on a daily basis. We're going to promote the hell out of this book and we adore you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much,
Laura.
All right. You take care. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Remember all of our sponsors, every single one of them, and our special sponsors today, ADT Home Security, Genucel, Delta Animal Rescue, Pluto TV. Make sure that you support these great, great businesses across America. They support us. They bring this podcast to you free every week. The Laura Ingraham Podcast, America, now and forever. We'll see you next time.